This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
The Dry Cleaner Cast presents Need to Know. Need to Know is a new quarterly podcast featuring conversations with security experts focused on the terrorism and intelligence stories dominating the headlines. This podcast is written, edited, and presented by Chris Carr. This is Need to Know.
Today we're joined by Fred Burton as part of our series of special podcasts on the Salisbury poisoning. Fred was the Deputy Chief of the Counterterrorism Division of the State Department's Diplomatic Security Service. He is currently the Vice President of Stratfor, which is a global intelligence firm tracking global security and international affairs. Fred will be sharing his views on the Salisbury poisoning, and we will also be discussing the series of parcel bombings that have taken place in Austin, Texas. I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you for listening.
Opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the filmmakers and sponsors of the film, The Dry Cleaner.
Fred, welcome to Need to Know.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Just for listeners who may not be familiar with you, even though they should be if they listened to last month's episode, if they're not familiar with you and your work, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Be happy to. My name is Fred Burton, and I'm the Chief Security Officer here at Stratfor in Austin, Texas. We're a geopolitical analysis firm. And before I came to Stratfor, I was a special agent with the State Department, and specifically the Deputy Chief of the State Department's Counterterrorism Division.
Now, as a former counterterrorism agent, what are your thoughts on the Salisbury poisoning?
Well, I think it was a brilliant operation on the part of the Russians to carry out that kind of targeted assassination, to be quite blunt. It certainly resonates in the counterintelligence and the counterterrorism space, because if you look at that kind of targeted killing using a nerve agent, there are certainly counterterrorism ramifications for that, although the motive might have been laser fixated on counterintelligence. So it crosses that threshold, a bridge into both disciplines, Chris.
Yeah. Now, you've investigated cases in the past where the KGB were suspected of using poisons and nerve agents to kill their targets. And I remember in your book that you mentioned that the KGB loves to use sort of chemical compounds to kill its adversaries. Can you just talk to us a little bit about some of these experiences of those cases that you've worked on?
Oh, my goodness. The Russian KGB, you know, now the SVR and FSB, they have a long history of targeting mostly defectors and double agents going back for years, not only throughout Europe, but in many cases around the world. And we certainly have a very suspicious case in the Washington, D.C. Area where another foe of Putin mysteriously was either beaten to death or fell down some stairs that was found dead in a hotel room. And, you know, that case kind of never added up in my mind. I'm very familiar with that area and the hotel. So when you look at the Russian use of targeting defectors and double agents, to me, it's a study of assassination that you literally could could do a PhD thesis on, just trying to make sense of that. And I think it's a tool of foreign policy, Chris. I think they utilize these targeted assassinations, very mindful of the signal and how it's going to resonate not only inside the United Kingdom, in your case, but around the world. And you can see the global response as a result of that with the expulsion of Russian intelligence officers literally around the globe.
Yeah, it's been some historic expulsions almost, really, of the levels of people being expelled en masse.
Certainly. I've never seen anything like it in mass. I of course, on social media was strongly encouraging the British FCO to respond. And it's really a double-edged sword on a practical problem, and I'll tell you why. The UK, the US, the Five Eyes do a real good job of databasing, monitoring, knowing who are the suspected Russian intelligence officers, or in many cases, known intelligence officers. So you have them, to use the jargon, painted. You know who they are. You can watch them. You can monitor them. You can keep tabs on them. And so when you boot them out, it begins again. You have to go back and start looking at others that might have come in, for example, in the UK under diplomatic cover. And what you have seen, or at least I have seen over the years with the Russians, are they're quite good at adapting to these kinds of things, meaning if you declare diplomats persona non grata as intelligence officers, they'll just do a course correction, they'll triangulate out, they'll go to other countries and do third country operations. So, for example, utilize other Western countries in Europe to springboard into the UK. They'll compartment and heavy up on their illegals operation, very, very similar to what, the TV show The Americans here that's running inside the United States, where they will have deep embeds into the fabric of society, and then utilize, business cover, Russian front companies and travelers and so forth, academics. So rest assured, their level of espionage won't decrease simply because most of the world has booted out a few suspected intelligence officers.
Yeah, and the Russian intelligence services are sort of considered one of the best in the world, aren't they?
Without a doubt. They are as capable as the American CIA, the British MI6, the Israeli Mossad, the Iranian MOIS. The list is long. And in some ways, they really are very brutal when it comes to targeting those that they have declared to be enemies of the state. And I say that with knowledge of certainly how our intelligence services and the Western intelligence services work. Contrary to what's in the books or in the movies, you don't see the American CIA or the British MI6 going out and targeting double agents in assassination operations or poisoned kind of bizarre plans that you would only read in a thriller novel. So it's a different kind of mindset. With that, it kind of puts that fear into those that might be thinking of working for the West or working for the Brits or working for the Americans. And so part of their tactics are just to do that. So that resonates throughout the service.
And that would make sense. I mean, because this poisoning has become a very public affair, even if it had been successful, I think, you know, there still would have been an investigation. I don't, you know, these people weren't going to die and it looked like natural causes, and it kind of just sort of falls to the wayside. So, yeah, a lot of people have been asking, well, why would Russia do it in this way? And so you feel it's sort of to send a message to sort of other would-be defectors and traitors who might be thinking about it or something.
Bar none. I think it was a very strong signal to those that have already defected. But more importantly, to those agents that might still be in place working for the West, that there's a price to be paid for treachery. And not only is that price your own life, but we will reach out and touch your family. So I think that's a very scary kind of position, obviously, to be in when you're on the fence. You're thinking about betraying your country to begin with, and now you got to worry about this kind of retribution. But so I think that was the primary motive here. One, he was accessible. Two, it was done just to signal to others that you better think twice or else.
Mm. With these kind of nerve agents, what kind of delivery systems would be used if they're weaponized? I was reading something somewhere about there are reports of that the SVR developed some sort of vaping type device that can, you know, spray out things to people. I mean, all sorts of sort of theories have kind of come out about how it's being delivered, and on top of that, the police have come out and saying that the door handle might well have been a key part of what happened. What kind of delivery systems have you sort of come across in your time?
Well, and I think this one, although we don't know specifically what delivery mechanism was used yet in this case, I think that will eventually come out at some point. At times, if you do have sources in place, word will get back either through MI6 or the CIA or someone specifically. But they probably have a good working theory, meaning the Novichok, as I understand it, is ultra fine powder, and that, you know, once inhaled or ingested or absorbed through the skin, it certainly can be deadly. So when you think of that in that context, and let's say it was placed on the doorknob, I initially thought that it might have been in some form of mist or some sort of spray, you know, your simple spray bottles that, you know, you bring the nerve agent in, possibly through a diplomatic pouch. I would certainly not rule that out, or through a intelligence officer, courier, cutout of some sort, and mix the nerve agent and then simply walk up and either spray it on a doorknob or door handle or on the door in some capacity. Would be, to me, the most logical. However, you certainly could think of other methods of delivery to include, you know, some form of envelope where you just sprinkle the powder on the doorknob and so forth. You know, to me, I know that that's going to be a very interesting point to nail down just from an investigative perspective. The other thing I would be honing in on, and I'm sure, you know, knowing how capable and how good Scotland Yard and MI5 are, would be, you know, hopeful that you could find some sort of surveillance footage of even a snippet of someone, you know, approaching in the suspected time frame, and then trying to rule in or out those that have what we would call cover for action, meaning, you know, a delivery person, a package delivery, you know, some sort of person that might blend into the neighborhood that you might not think twice about, but was in essence used to convey that to the scene. That's something I would be looking for those kinds of personnel that would have either in a disguise or that you could either wittingly dupe into doing this, or I guess you could also consider some sort of unwitting soul in some capacity.
Yeah. And if you were assigned this case yourself today, how would you go about investigating it? What would you be looking for?
Well, the forensics are certainly the place to start. I would also hone heavily in to that window of time, back off an hour on each side of your timeline and hone in on your video surveillance leading up to the house as far back as you could go to from a distance perspective. You know, if you're looking at an old school map, figure out exactly where your surveillance cameras are, walk back the cat from that. I would also be requesting through the intelligence community, I would work it up through the chain and get intelligence requirements sent to all Five Eyes countries to for their assessment of what they think had happened, as well as a requirements request, we would call them, for any Russian sources for information pertaining to this. I would also be laser focused on the travel of Russian diplomatic couriers, trying to timeline out when the last courier pouch came in. I would be reviewing any and all surveillance tape and footage and so forth in and around the Russian embassy in London to see if there was unusual behavior, unusual activity, you know, elevated, you know, lights on, burning the midnight oil kind of activity, old school surveillance log work.
But there have been a lot of commentators expressing shock at the suggestion that the Russian government would be so bold to be behind this poisoning. Do you think it's far-fetched to believe that the Russian state is behind this?
No, I think the Russian state did it. I think the Russian state was behind the previous polonium 210 assassination in London.
Yeah, the Litvinenko killing.
Yes, therefore there wasn't a lot of retribution, or there wasn't any kind of pound of flesh extracted for that. So I think they looked at that kind of case and said, well, we got away with it before. Who's to say we can't get away with it again? Now, also, though, you know, how are you defining success, Chris? Meaning they're probably sitting around SVR, FSB headquarters, regardless of the reaction of the British government and others, and saying this was a successful mission. You know, they did not go forth with this without knowing there'd be some degree of blowback. But, you know, at the end of the day, I fully believe the Russian state intelligence organs and perhaps even Putin himself believes this was a highly successful mission.
Mm. And how well do you think the Russian government have handled this?
I think it's fascinating to watch, you know, their lines come out of the Russian embassy in London about pointing the finger to the British security services and some. You know, there's the old phrase that we would use from time to time in the intelligence business, you know, admit nothing, deny everything, and make counter accusations. And I think that that's exactly what the Russian government is doing, and you know, trying to turn the tables, but I don't think they're going to be successful. I think the court of public opinion has already turned, you know, against them on that. But at the end of the day, I don't think they give a tinker's damn. I think they went into this operation with eyes wide open, knowing that it would cause a kerfluffle, but still decided to do it.
Yeah. And out of interest, what's the reaction been to this in the United States?
Well, here at Stratfor, we certainly have followed it intensely because of you know, what could be the nation state attack on UK soil, to be blunt. But it's gotten a large measure of press here inside the states on the activities, and then of course the you know, the American response in concert with, you know, the world's response and just booting out Russian diplomats. And so it's also rehashed the suspicious death of the Putin foe inside the hotel in the Washington, D.C. area. I know this, if I was at the American FBI and if we have defectors in place here you certainly are worried about them as well, which raises an also interesting challenge, I think, for Scotland Yard and MI5, Chris, is the others that you might have under protection that are either known or unknown. This places a protective security challenge for defectors that haven't been hit yet. So you're worried about that taking place again. So there's a broad in the protective security business where I spent a fair amount of my time as well. There's tremendous blowback here that certainly resonates as you look to safeguard other Russian defectors from the same thing happening to them.
What kind of level of protection would be sort of adequate for those sort of individuals?
Well, it would be very discreet and low-key before this incident. And the moment that this incident happened, bureaucracies are reactive for the most part, not proactive. So there's going to be a knee-jerk reaction to immediately ramp up security for those that you already have under your wing. You might take them into protective custody. You might move them. You will enhance your surveillance detection upon them. You're going to be relying heavily on the intelligence chatter to see who else might have been looked at, which is the kind of elephant in the room here, just behind the scenes. I do want to mention this, Chris, is if I was also working this case, I would want to know, well, who else was looked at and we just don't know it. So that is the whodunit. You know, it's kind of like when you have the trial unfolding here in the States, over the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, Florida. And now all the testimony is coming out to say that, well, a Disney property was looked at first. So you look at this kind of case and say, okay, Mr. Skripal and his daughter were targeted here, but who else was on the target list? Who else perhaps was looked at first? So you are going to want to figure that out pretty darn quickly. So that challenge becomes almost an analytical and what we would call a protective intelligence gap. You want to figure out the others that might be next or the others that were surveilled. I would be highly surprised, Chris, if others were not also looked at.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's going to be a lot of work now for, I suppose, MI5 and Scotland Yard looking into this.
Oh, without a doubt. I have no doubt that was probably done within the first week once this started coming together. But it's probably still being evaluated as we speak to try to figure out who else might have been under reconnaissance. That's how you save lives going forward. You learn all you can about the modus operandi of this case. You elevate your intelligence collection around all things Russia, SVR, and FSB. And then you do threat assessments on your other defectors that you have in place and increase your surveillance detection around them.
This may sound a silly question, but I'm sure there'll be some listeners who would be interested in this. How do professional assassins operate? Sort of what level of surveillance and how long would they typically spend if there is a typical time one spends on surveying a target?
Well, it depends on the target. For example, you take a group like Al-Qaeda when they were carrying out some of their terrorist plots. They would study targets for a long period of time before they move forward. Now, in these kinds of targeted assassinations that are, remember, you have the benefit of a state intelligence service to help you. So anything you can imagine that's in the open source is going to be at your disposal. So you're going to very quickly be able to do all your social media deep dives. You're going to be able to check records for tax information. You're going to be able to determine residences and registrations on cars. Then you're typically going to put out a surveillance team to look at targets, many different targets, unless one is readily identified early on by headquarters. And we don't know the answer to that question. You know, I would say it's reasonable that others were also looked at, and for whatever reason, they chose to pick Skripal because maybe it was something as simple as he was a little bit off the beaten path, or the assessment team looked at him and said, you know, look, we can get in and out of here without pinging many videotape kind of issues. So it could be something as simple as that. So, you know, you're operating under a lot of intelligence gaps at this point, not knowing that, but it typically involves big data scrapes. That's easy to do when you're a state intelligence service. You can also put boots on the ground to do surveillance detection to watch. And then typically a hitman is going to come in to just specifically do that and be out of the country in the same day.
So the shooter or the hit person would just come in and out, whilst everybody else, the support team, would be around for a bit longer.
Correct. He's going to he or she, and let's not rule that out here. We don't know. It very well could be a she. You're going to have a very robust targeting package that says this is where the victim, the intended target, lives. This is going to be how we're going to do it, and we need you to walk up to the door and spray this on and get out. So when you think about it on a simplistic level, it's not that much of a complicated kind of attack, because the benefit that a nerve agent or a toxin or a poison does, much like we saw with the polonium-210 case before, is it affords you the ability to get out of Dodge, to get the heck out of town before someone is before someone uncovers exactly what took place. So let's say, and I'm just speculating here, if the decision was to use a firearm, which is unusual in the UK, as you and I know, you're going to have to get that shooter out quickly because of the methodology of delivery. But if you're using a toxin or a poison, then you're going to be able to buy yourself some time to evade detection and get out of the country.
Yeah, because, I mean, if they did put it on a door handle, they could have put that on at, like, sort of 3 or 4 in the morning. And then if the person, the target, doesn't open the door to about midday, there's quite a significant period of time for you to get away from it.
Absolutely. I would bet that the assassin came in a day or two before, did a final walkthrough, thought about it, the method of delivery based on a briefing from a surveillance team, and then acted and was probably back in Mother Russia the same day.
Before we, I'd like to have a look at the Austin parcel bombings, but before we do move on, are there any other thoughts on Salisbury poison that we haven't covered that's important to you?
Well, I hate to keep repeating this, but I think this is an important aspect that I've heard nobody talk about, Chris, and that's what were the other targets? There's never, ever just one. And there's usually a tiered kind of target set. So those are the kinds of questions that need to be answered so we can protect the others and we can all learn from this to try to keep other defectors alive.
Yeah. And the better we do that, then the more likely people are going to cooperate with our intelligence services.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Now, Fred, we follow each other on Twitter, and I've seen that you've been following the Austin parcel bombing case. Sadly, in the UK, there hasn't been much coverage of it, but can you just talk us through what's been happening?
Well, we had a package bomber that was, at this stage, randomly leaving devices in our city in a very high tempo rate that was taking place on the edges of Austin, Texas, during a huge international festival we were having here called South by Southwest, and it has grown to extraordinarily large proportions. So you had the bulk of the police force drawn downtown, and then you had this package bomber striking around the city on the edges, you know, touching areas, you know, from a large patch of demographics and economic areas from lower to higher. And then he made a mistake by mailing a package that exploded at a FedEx distribution center that was tracked back to a local FedEx drop-off point, which enabled the FBI and the ATF and the local police to identify him pretty rapidly. And as they were closing in on him, he literally detonated another bomb in his car and killed himself. And we have all kinds of speculation swirling as to, you know, was this the work of just a lone, mentally disturbed person, or was this terrorism? You know, that's still being hotly debated here in the United States press and media over the motive of what caused this. But at this stage, depending on who you talk to, it's either viewed as domestic terrorism or it's not. But I think the randomness of this, Chris, was the thing that pretty much terrorized our city. You know, his targeted actions in our city of Austin, Texas alone, just caused so much chaos and disruption here, because he first was leaving bombs in the dead of the night on people's doorsteps, and then you would walk outside and find a package bomb on your door, and it was just frightening, and a lot of hysteria as a result of it.
Were there any sort of patterns to who the victims were of his bombings?
No, there were not. And that was one of the other interesting things that came out of this. You know, at first, the first target was, you know, an African-American. Then there was a Hispanic victim. Then another target was in an upper middle class white Caucasian neighborhood, with just kids riding their bikes down the street. And it was just one of these kinds of the randomness of this was just the terrorizing part. And living and working here in the city, I could certainly say that this mad bomber did terrorize us, and it just captivated the American media for, you know, quite some time, for a good 10 days to 2 weeks.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you. So it was a 10-day period that this was sort of taking place.
It was. And, you know, the bomber, you know, came from what appears to be a very good family. And there didn't appear to be any, you know, previous criminal history or... he left a very pointed video statement with motive, which the police have not released yet. So we all are kind of waiting here in the States for more information to come out of exactly what he said. But apparently in his statement he left behind, which was recorded on the phone, he justifies in his mind why he went about carrying on these bombings, and identified himself as a psychopath. Reportedly, there was no political motivation for this, but it's raised a lot of questions in the city from a transparency perspective as to, you know, we'll release the tape so we can make our own conclusion why this person decided to target these houses and these families and so forth. So it's been quite controversial here, and it's still percolating along.
Yeah, cause I know there's been a lot of should we say sort of debate and accusations in the media, and you know, on social media about the way the press has treated it. Some people are sort of saying the double standards, because, you know, if it were ISIS or something, they feel it would be treated in a different way to this guy, Mark Anthony Condit, who is a sort of white middle class boy, as far as we know.
Exactly. And Those are the kind of accusations going around town here that I think everybody was kind of waiting for a claim of responsibility, whether that be from, you know, a international or domestic terrorist group. You know, because of the victims early on, a lot of the media was centered on, well, perhaps we have a white hate extremist that was targeting the black community. And we just don't know, you know, when it comes to, you know, his specific motivation at this point. So I expect this to be released at some point. You know, I think probably the police and the FBI is just, you know, wanting to buy some time from an investigative perspective, just so emotions kind of simmer down a bit before they release this videotape that he made and unseal a bunch of their forensic evidence surrounding the bombs.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of reminds me of two cases. I think in terms of the bombs themselves, it reminds me of the Unabomber. And then in terms of the, not sure what the motive is, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the Las Vegas shooter from last year.
Well, I think, Chris, you raise a very good point from a modus operandi perspective. I know in some of the media interviews I did surrounding the case, you know, the motive behind the Las Vegas shooter is still not disclosed. And we don't have a motive here. You had, although the shooter used a rifle and randomly killed, this individual used bombs and was randomly killed people, but there hasn't been a motive identified. If so, it hasn't been disclosed. So from a psychological modeling perspective or behavioral profiling, there was a lot of similarities to that. I remember vividly the Unabomber case because that happened on my watch when I was in Washington. And the Unabomber mailed a lot of bombs around the country to various locations and colleges and academics and so forth. And to be quite honest, the only reason he was ever caught was the mind hunters down at the FBI decided to disclose a manifesto that he had written. And his brother, the Unabomber's brother, recognized the handwriting and said, you know, I think that's my crazy brother, Ted. And eventually Ted Kaczynski was tracked down to, you know, a remote cabin out in the West and arrested for his crimes. But, you know, our bomber stayed localized here, was very Austin-centric. You know, I thought all along that we had a bomber that knew our city well, was into the ebb and flow of our city, knew our transportation routes. Texas is a huge state, as you can imagine, but, you know, Austin has just a few roads basically to come in and out of different parts of the city. So, you know, I kind of believed early on in the case that this was someone that lived here and just knew our city well. And, you know, that proved to be true.
And I suppose he must have had some sort of mechanical knowledge to be able to successfully build these parcel bombs, because, I mean, are they particularly easy to make?
Well, you know, I've been to those schools to make them, and I've been to those schools to investigate the bombings, and surprisingly, it is fairly simple to make a bomb. Now, to get a bomb to work correctly each and every time is a bit of a challenge. So a lot of us were befuddled in this case early on, because every bomb that he dropped off actually worked. And that's usually not the case. For example, you know, the Times Square bomber, that bomb malfunctioned. The Unabomber had devices that didn't work. So, you know, this was someone that practiced or was very, very lucky. Now, what we don't know is exactly how he learned. That's one of the key points here that hasn't been disclosed. We don't know exactly how he learned how to make these bombs. There's a lot of speculation. It was just something as simple as the internet. There has been pretty good surveillance footage of him purchasing bomb supplies at your local electronics store. So, you know, that explains how he got some of the components. He had ordered some off the internet, but there's, interestingly, it just goes to show you how things kind of come together or the dots are connected after a case, neighbors remember loud explosions or noises in the middle of the night that they attributed to, for example, transformers blowing. But in retrospect, there's speculation that he was actually going outside at night in his backyard just blowing up the bombs to see if they would work.
It's not very discreet, that, is it?
No, almost asking to be caught in many ways. But he lived in a town just north of our city called Pflugerville, that's part of the Austin metropolis, for lack of better words. And it is a tad bit rural, but not that rural. And, you know, sleepy, quiet neighborhood at night, you would like to think if someone heard an explosion, they would have called the cops. But that doesn't appear to have happened.
No. I mean, I suppose I grew up in the country. I used to have I went through a gun phase in my sort of teens. I was firing blank guns or air rifles, so I'm sure my neighbors heard lots of bangs. And I suppose people get used to it. So I don't know if he had a history of firing guns or anything, did he?
Right. Well, here in Texas, there's certainly no shortage of guns. They're everywhere and certainly accessible, and you can walk into any gun store and do that. And, you know, the lesson learned here for this kind of person is, although we still have gaps on what made him tick, is that if someone is committed to doing something like this, I'm sad to say, they can be successful. And so he, in all probability, you know, learned to put these darn things together just on the internet.
Yeah. And was he making them at home?
Yes. Yes. It appears that he was making them. He lived with two roommates. His father actually owned the house that he was living in. And then he had two roommates. And as best we can tell, he was making the bombs in his room. And neither one of his roommates knew anything about it, although one of his roommates was grilled pretty heavily by the FBI as being a person of interest, but he's subsequently been let go. It appears that he acted alone.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll find out more in due course, but thank you for that. Are there any other, before we finish up, actually, are there any more thoughts on the past bombings that we haven't covered?
I think we pretty much covered the Austin bombers. Still a lot of unknown questions that hopefully will be answered over the next week or so. And we'll certainly know more about perhaps what made this person want to target these residences.
Yeah. Well, Fred, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, certainly you could follow us at www.stratfor.com. STRATFOR is our website. I'm on Twitter at Fred_Burton, and you'll find more information than you care to on our website or on my Twitter account.
Excellent. Well, look, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter at DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a DryCleanerCast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/DryCleanerCast. That's patreon.com/DryCleanerCast. Thanks for listening. This is Need to Know.